Welcome, everyone, to the Savitri Circle on Infinite Conversations. We are entering into Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 11, The Kingdoms and Godheads of the Greater Mind. This canto I have labeled The World Stare in detail. It does walk us through all the ascending planes of consciousness and the various parts of our being, even though it's centered on bringing us to the greater mind worlds. Again, the kingdoms are realms, evolutionary realms, and the godheads are types, entities with whom we can come in touch with that can potentially aid us in our evolution. So after a meditation, how about we we're doing a discussion after each section. How about we start with John Roberts, and then Marco, then Andrea, and Jeffrey, and then myself.
Book 2, The Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 11, The Kingdoms and Godheads of the Greater Mind. There ceased the limits of the laboring power, but being and creation ceased not there. for thought transcends the circles of mortal mind. It is greater than its earthly instrument. The Godhead crammed into mind's narrow space escapes on every side to some vast that is a passage to infinity. It moves eternal in the spirit's field, a runner towards the far spiritual light, a child and servant of the spirit's force. But mind too falls back from a nameless peak. His being stretched beyond the sight of thought. For the spirit is eternal and unmade, and not by thinking was its greatness born, and not by thinking can its knowledge come. It knows itself, and in itself it lives. It moves where no thought is nor any form. Its feet are steadied upon finite things. Its wings can dare to cross the infinite. Arriving into his ken, a wonder space of great and marvelous meetings called his steps, where thought leaned on a vision beyond thought and shaped a world from the unthinkable. On peaks imagination cannot tread, in the horizons of a tireless sight, under a blue veil of eternity, the splendors of ideal mind were seen outstretched across the boundaries of things known. Origin of the little that we are, instinct with the endless more that we must be, a prop of all that human strength enacts. Creator of hopes by earth unrealized, it spreads beyond the expanding universe. It wings beyond the boundaries of dream. It overtops the ceiling of life's soar.
Awake in a luminous sphere, unbound by thought, exposed to omniscient immensities. It casts on our world its great crowned influences, its speed that outstrips the ambling of the hours, its force that strides invincibly through time. Its mights that bridge the gulf twixt man and God. Its lights that combat ignorance and death. In its vast ambit of ideal space, where beauty and mightiness walk hand in hand, the spirit's truths take form as living gods, and each can build a world in its own right. In an air which doubt and error cannot mark with the stigmata of their deformity, in communion with the musing privacy of a truth that sees in an unerring light, where the sight falters not nor wanders thought, exempt from our world's exorbitant tax of tears, dreaming its luminous creation's gaze on the ideas that people eternity. In a sunblaze of joy and absolute power, above the masters of the ideal throne, in sessions of secure felicity, in regions of illumined certitude. Far are those realms from our labor and yearning, and call. Perfection's reign and hallowed sanctuary closed to the uncertain thoughts of human mind, remote from the turbid tread of mortal life. But since our secret selves are next of kin, a breath of unattained divinity visits the imperfect earth on which we toil. Across a gleaming ether's golden laugh, a light falls on our vexed, unsatisfied lives. A thought comes down from the ideal worlds and moves us to new model, even here, some image of their greatness and appeal and wonder beyond the ken of mortal hope.
Amid the heavy sameness of the days and contradicted by the human law, a faith in things that are not and must be lives comrade of this world's delight and pain. The child of the secret soul's forbidden desire, born of its amour with eternity. Our spirits break free from their environment. The future brings its face of miracle near. Its Godhead looks at us with present eyes. Acts deemed impossible grow natural. We feel the hero's immortality, the courage and the strength death cannot touch, awake in limbs that are mortal, hearts that fail. We move by the rapid impulse of a will that scorns the tardy trudge of mortal time. These promptings come not from an alien sphere. Ourselves are citizens of that mother state. Adventurers, we have colonized matter's night. But now our rights are barred, our passports void. We live self-exiled from our heavenlier home. An errant ray from the immortal mind accepted the earth's blindness and became our human thought, servant of ignorance. An exile, laborer on this unsure globe, captured and driven in life's nescient grasp, hampered by obscure cell and treacherous nerve, it dreams of happier states and nobler powers, the natural privilege of unfallen gods, recalling still its old lost sovereignty. Amidst earth's mist and fog and mud and stone, it still remembers its exalted sphere and the high city of its splendid birth.
A memory steals in from lost heavens of truth. A wide release comes near. A glory calls. A might looks out, an estranged felicity. In glamorous passages of half-veiled light wandering, a brilliant shadow of itself, this quick, uncertain leader of blind gods, this tender of small lamps, this minister serf hired by a mind and body for earth use forgets its work mid crude realities. It recovers its renounced imperial right. It wears once more a purple robe of thought and knows itself the ideal seer and king, communicant and prophet of the unborn, heir to delight and immortality. All things are real that here are only dreams. In our unknown depths sleeps their reserve of truth. On our unreached heights they reign and come to us in thought and muse, trailing their robes of light. But our dwarf will and cold pragmatic sense admit not the celestial visitants. Awaiting us on the ideal's peaks or guarded in our secret self, unseen yet flashed sometimes across the awakened soul, hide from our lives their greatness, beauty, power. Our present feels sometimes their regal touch. Our future strives towards their luminous thrones. Out of spiritual secrecy they gaze. Immortal footfalls in mind's corridors sound. Our souls can climb into the shining plains. The breaths from which they came can be our home. His privilege regained of shadowless sight, the thinker entered the immortal's air and drank again his pure and mighty source. Immutable, in rhythmic calm and joy, he saw, sovereignly free in limitless light, the unfallen plains, the thought-created worlds, where knowledge is the leader of the act and matter is of thinking substance made. Feeling, a heaven bird poised on dreaming wings, answers truth's call as to a parent's voice. Form luminous leaps from the all-shaping beam, and will is a conscious chariot of the gods, and life, a splendor stream of musing force, carries the voice of the mystic suns.
A happiness it brings of whispered truth. There runs in its flow, honeying the bosom of space, a laughter from the immortal heart of bliss and the unfathomed joy of timelessness, the sound of wisdom's murmur in the unknown, and the breath of an unseen infinity. In gleaming clarities of amethyst air, the chainless and omnipotent spirit of mind brooded on the blue lotus of the idea. A gold supernal sun of timeless truth poured down the mystery of the eternal ray through a silence quivering with the word of light on an endless ocean of discovery. Far off, he saw the joining hemispheres. On meditation's mounting edge of trance, great stairs of thought climbed up to unborn heights, where time's last ridges touch eternity's skies, and nature speaks to the spirit's absolute.
I don't have much to say, but it seems like this is a setup for the canto to come, where this world stare that you told us about is going to be described. And the key distinction is between mortal mind and immortal mind. There's another kind of tier of mind, if you will, only kind of partially participates in the reality that we typically experience in mortal mind. The we here is, I take it, kind of our everyday existence, our modern world as well. Not just the modern world, I guess, like any aspect of human existence that is time-bound and finite. So now we're moving beyond that. We're ascending to that peak where I think he described the peaks of time meet the heavens of eternity. It almost seems that the insights that we get are kind of accidental and arbitrary. That's almost what it seems like. I'm not saying that that's what he's saying, but these errant rays, they just seem to happen to fall like upon our poor souls. But they're just a minute fraction of the totality of that divine. That's my read of this.
I think that's when our souls feel blessed. Those are the moments of grace, you know, when suddenly something comes over us of greater than ourselves, than our limited mind.
That's why I showed up here today. Just an errant ray of grace. I might happen to catch. I just point my mirrors the right way.
Now, Marco, let us know if you figure out what exactly the right mirror angle is, will you?
Well, I was disappointed to hear that the Arecibo telescope in Puerto Rico has collapsed. That's just a random association, perhaps, but came to mind. And I didn't realize it was used for like contact, ET contact research, but is also being used by scientists to this day for a lot of other purposes. That's not related exactly to the text, or maybe it is.
Shall I continue? A triple realm of ordered thought came first. A small beginning of immense ascent. Above were bright ethereal skies of mind. A packed and endless soar, as if sky pressed sky, buttressed against the void on bastioned light. The highest strove to neighbor eternity, the largest widened into the infinite. But though immortal, mighty, and divine, the first realms were close and kin to human mind. Their deities' shape are greater thinking's roads. A fragment of their puissance can be ours. These breadths were not too broad for our souls to range. These heights were not too high for human hope.
A triple flight led to this triple world. Although abrupt for common strengths to tread, its upward slope looks down on our earth poise. On a slant not too precipitously steep, one could turn back, traveling deep descending lines to commune with the mortal's universe. the mighty wardens of the ascending stair who intercede with the all-creating word, there waited for the pilgrim heaven-bound soul. Holding the thousand keys of the beyond, they proffered their knowledge to the climbing mind and filled the life with thought's immensities. The prophet hierophants of the occult law, the flame-bright hierarchs of the divine truth, interpreters between man's mind and God's, they bring the immortal fire to mortal men. Iridescent, bodying the invisible, the guardians of the eternal's bright degrees fronted the sun in radiant phalanxes. Afar, they seemed a symbol imagery, illumined originals of the shadowy script in which our sight transcribes the ideal ray, or icons figuring a mystic truth, but nearer, gods and living presences. A march of friezes marked the lowest steps, fantastically ornate and richly small. They had room for the whole meaning of a world, symbols minute of its perfection's joy, strange beasts that were nature's forces made alive, and wakened to the wonder of his role, man grown an image undefaced of God, and objects the fine coin of beauty's reign. But why the terrains were those levels serve?
In front of the ascending epiphany, world times enjoyers, favorites of world bliss, the masters of things actual, lords of the hours, playmates of youthful nature and child God, creators of matter by hid stress of mind, whose subtle thoughts support unconscious life and guide the fantasy of brute events, stood there a race of young, keen-visioned gods, king children born on wisdom's early plane, taught in her school world-making's mystic play, arch-masons of the eternal thaumaturge, molders and measurers of fragmented space, they have made their plan of the concealed and known a dwelling house for the invisible king. Obeying the eternal's deep command, they have built in the material front of things this wide world kindergarten of young souls where the infant spirit learns through mind and sense to read the letters of the cosmic script and study the body of the cosmic self and search for the secret meaning of the whole. To all that spirit conceives, they give a mold. Persuading nature into visible moods, they lend a finite shape to infinite things. Each power that leaps from the unmanifest, leaving the largeness of the eternal's peace, they seized and held by their precision eye, and made a figurant in the cosmic dance. Its free caprice they bound by rhythmic laws and compelled to accept its posture and its line in the wizardry of an ordered universe. The all-containing was contained in form. Oneness was carved into units measurable. The limitless built into a cosmic sum, unending space was beaten into a curve, indivisible time into small minutes cut, the infinitesimal massed to keep secure the mystery of the formless cast into form.
Invincibly, their craft devised for use the magic of sequent number and signs spell. Design's miraculous potency was caught, laden with beauty and significance, and by the determining mandate of their gaze, figure and quality equating joined in an inextricable identity. On each event, they stamped its curves of law and its trust and charge of burden circumstance. A free and divine incident, no more, at each moment willed or adventure of the soul. It lengthened a fate-bound mysterious chain, a line foreseen of an immutable plan. One step more in necessity's long march. A term was set for every eager power restraining its will to monopolize the world. A groove of bronze prescribed for force and act, and shown to each moment its appointed place, forewilled inalterably in the spiral huge time loop fugitive from eternity. Inevitable, their thoughts like links of fate, imposed on the leap and lightning race of mind, and on the frail fortuitous flux of life, and on the liberty of atomic things, immutable cause and adamant consequence. Idea gave up the plastic infinity to which it was born and now traced out instead small separate steps of chain work in a plot. Immortal once, now tied to birth and end, torn from its immediacy of errorless sight, knowledge was rebuilt from cells of inference into a fixed body flask and perishable. Thus bound it grew, but could not last, and broke, and to a new thinking's body left its place.
A cage for the infinite's great-eyed seraphim, thoughts was closed, with a crisscross of world laws for bars, and hedged into a curt horizon's arc, and the irised vision of the ineffable. A timeless spirit was made the slave of the hours. The unbound was cast into a prison of birth to make a world that mind could grasp and rule. On an earth which looked towards a thousand suns, that the created might grow nature's lord and matter's depths be illumined with a soul they tied to date and norm and finite scope, the million mysteried movement of the one.
Let's stop there for just a minute and okay. See if anyone, because there's not a break for quite a while.
When I read this kind of line in, or these kinds of lines in Savitri, I think nobody can write like this. It's impossible.
I had the same feeling.
How could anybody human possibly write like this?
I have so much resonance left over from yesterday with Jeffrey and Vishnu, where we, yeah, you too, Jeffrey, where we're looking at Indra and Agastya trying to take the kingdom of heaven by storm and bypassing Indra, who symbolizes this realm. Indra's the personification of higher mind. And they're having this back and forth, Agastya and Indra, and Agastya ends up getting beaten up by Indra's younger brothers, the Maruts. They pummel him. And Agastya's like, what the hell, Indra? Why are you, I'm trying to evolve. And he's saying, you can't evolve past this. You can't bypass this. You need my help. And you need the help of the fire. You need the help of matter. You need the help of Agni to be well kindled, to be properly burning, to make it through this. It's really quite beautiful. And then here we are, the passage in the Veda is super small and in comparison, ineloquent, actually. Like, to see this, to be basking in this realm with this degree of eloquence is just, it's super special. And it makes me, it solidifies that notion that Savitri is the fifth Veda. A big claim, but I actually don't think so. It might be a small claim. That might be, if anything, it might be, there's no hyperbole in there. It's the exact opposite. It's easily the fifth Veda.
Yeah, I was certainly thinking about our discussion yesterday about Indra and the readings of Indra when we started in on this chapter, on this canto. Yeah. It has, Matteo, I think, gave you a flavor for what we were looking at, but the verses on Indra have, so we've been reading the verses on, we read Agni, we read another god, Brihaspati, and we read Soma. And so we've been reading different gods from the Veda pantheon. And this was the first, for me anyway, the first sort of delving into Indra, so the realm of the mind. And the verses, they're dramatically different from the others. They have a ethereal quality, a kind of, they speak to the intellect in a way that the other texts do not. And also to paradox, which was a bit of a surprise for me. I've been hearing about Indra for a while, and here you had the very heart of paradox inside these verses that deal with Indra. Because I guess mind, in a way, is a kind of a paradox in the context of soul and evolution. And there is a kind of paradox built into the idea that you can use this very rational, logical kind of part of the way we function to access these realms that are ineffable, right? So I think there's something, so there's a kind of resonance between what we were reading yesterday and what we're reading here that I think is interesting.
I'm familiar with Indra because of the net, Indra's net. And would be curious to hear how, in Aurobindo's view or your understanding, that net relates to mind.
God, I don't know, right? Indra's net of pearls is like a perfect symmetry between the microcosm and the macrocosm. Every pearl on the net is a cosmos in and of itself, reflecting perfectly the entire other, the macrocosm. And how that the link might be in the Kena Upanishad, where without mind, it's like we can't deny that we're mental beings. And that evolving mind has led us to a place where has led us to a place of conscious evolution. We can't be doing that without mind. We don't know that we're in, our lovely dogs are very conscious beings, but they're not conscious of being collaborators in the evolution. I'm pretty sure of that. Like, we can talk about consciousness all the way up and all the way down, but that's the thing that differentiates. And the thing that's beautiful about the Kena Upanishad is the gods have forgotten that they come from the eternal. And in the victory of the eternal, the gods grew to greatness, but their folly was, ours the victory, ours the greatness. And it's the folly of the human ego that comes from development of mind. And so the eternal challenges all the gods with a riddle that they can't solve by their power, the power of matter, Agni, the power of life, Vayu, then the power of mind, Indra. And when Indra, so Agni fails the challenge, Vayu fails the challenge, and then Indra comes in, and Indra goes toward the challenge, right? Mind going toward the paradox, doesn't understand. However, as soon as it gets close, it's almost like calculus. It's like expanding out to infinity or collapsing down to a singularity. As soon as it gets close, it disappears and comes into another realm. And then mind is standing there with Uma, the daughter of the snowy summits. I picture like wind blowing in the Himalaya. And Indra's like, Uma, what the hell was that? And she's like, it was the eternal, Indra. And in the victory of the eternal, you grew to greatness, and you're the first one that understands. You came nearest to the touch of that, with a capital T. So in some ways, Indra's net of pearls might be the mind aiding in the realization of the potential to collaborate in the evolution of human consciousness. But I've never heard Sri Aurobindo talk about Indra's net of pearls. I've only heard that in various other sources.
Hmm. Well, I think it's a beautiful image because it shows the interconnectedness of everything, like that net. I think that is what mind does, is mind establishes connections that are causal or that are associations between things, and like how the world works, how everything relates to everything else is what the mind distinguishes, because it can pinpoint what is one thing distinguished from another thing and how do they relate to each other. So those networks of relationship, I think, is what mind establishes. Like, that's what our understanding is, but it's not the next realm, like, is what I understand from the you know, it's not the eternal, it's just relations among finite things. And then we can begin to try to understand, the mind can begin to try to understand how the realms relate to each other and can go meta to itself, but it's still in the realm of relationships. It's still in the realm of establishing relationships among things. So I don't know, that's what comes to me. That's how I understand the idea, the metaphor of the net. And of course it's so pertinent these days because we have like the literal material, like manifestation of that in the internet. I remember one of the first ISPs that I think I signed up for here in Boulder was called Indra's Net. So I think they're still around, actually. What I resonated with particularly in this section was the worldwide kindergarten of young souls, and this because it relates. It's the idea that life is a kind of school, you know, and we're here to learn a set of lessons, perhaps, and we each have our curriculum or individualized curriculum, but through learning those lessons, through having our life experiences and connecting the dots mentally and then transcending the mind, we can graduate, as it were, to the next level. So I do have a question about this triple realm of ordered, it's the very beginning of the section we read, a triple realm of ordered thought came first. I was wondering what, maybe it's explained in the subsequent lines, but formally, like in Aurobindo's system, what is that triple realm?
There's generalities, we just came out of kingdoms and godheads of the little mind, where these generalities were really specific, and it was rational mind and vital mind and physical mind. So
is this like the illumined mind, intuitive mind, and higher mind?
No, thank you. Yeah. So that's kind of a vertical structure. I guess I'm talking about the circumambient structure. These two things kind of exist together with Sri Aurobindo, and that what you're talking about are the planes of consciousness, and I'm talking about the parts of the being. And the parts of the being, mind, life, and body, are all broken up into triples themselves. And so it's like the triple paradox is existing on all these planes, and it's spectral too. So mind has a mental mind, mind has a vital mind, mind has a physical mind, and ordered thought, a triple realm of ordered thought came first. I'm trying to think back to the previous canto. The vital mind was called the hunchback rider on the red wild ass, one of my favorites. And I just love that descriptor. It just makes me, yeah. And I think we all know that part of ourselves also. I certainly know mine well. And that I think that that's, I didn't question it too much, but he's going to, he's bringing us through the first part of it. I don't know. John Robert's probably singling out exactly what he meant by this. So I'll be quiet now if John Robert has anything to add.
Well, I wrote some numbers into this canto, and they're not, I don't think they're as clear for our little minds as they are elsewhere. But I have number one, let's see, creators of mind. This is on page 266, creators of mind. Stood there, a race of young triple, young keen-visioned gods, king children. They're the ones who set up the world kindergarten garden of young souls, as you were talking about, Marco. So that race of young keen-visioned gods, it's about 10 or 12 lines down from the top of page 266. And then I wrote for number two, which comes actually right after the break that we're taking. He says above, so we're going to step up now, stood a ranked subtle archangel race. And then, and so we'll be going into that shortly. And then on page 271, there's another break and another step up. You see the paragraph break on page 271.
Mm-hmm.
So then there he talks about the sovereign kings of thought. And I wrote down pure mind after that, but I don't know how it corresponds to Sri Aurobindo's terminology in the life divine, but it seems like he has his own terminology here in this canto. And those seem to be the three steps that he's talking about it in that the beginning of that section.
Thank you. So to recap, that's the one is the race of young keen-visioned gods, and then two is the subtle archangel race, and then three is the did you call them sovereigns of thought or the
sovereign kings of thought? It's on page 271. It's about four or five lines down after the paragraph break there.
Okay. Interesting.
Thank you, John Robert.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yes, thank you.
Shall I keep going? Above stood ranked a subtle archangel race with larger lids and looks that searched the unseen. A light of liberating knowledge shone across the gulfs of silence in their eyes. They lived in the mind and knew truth from within. A sight withdrawn in the concentrated heart could pierce behind the screen of time's results and the rigid cast and shape of visible things. All that escaped conception's narrow noose, vision descried and gripped. Their seeing thoughts filled in the blanks left by the seeking sense. High architects of possibility and the engineers of the impossible, mathematicians of the infinitudes and theoricians of unknowable truths. They formulate enigmas, postulates, and joined the unknown to the apparent worlds. Acolytes, they wait upon the timeless power. The cycle of her works investigate, passing her fence of wordless privacy. Their mind could penetrate her occult mind and draw the diagram of her secret thoughts. They read the codes and ciphers she had sealed, copies they made of all her guarded plans. For every turn of her mysterious course assigned a reason and unchanging rule.
The unseen grew visible to student eyes. Explained was the immense inconscience scheme. Audacious lines were traced upon the void. The infinite was reduced to square and cube. Arranging symbol and significance, tracing the curve of a transcendent power, they framed the Kabbalah of the cosmic law, the balancing line discovered of life's technique, and structured her magic and her mystery. Imposing schemes of knowledge on the vast, they clamped to syllogisms of finite thought, the free logic of an infinite consciousness, grammared the hidden rhythms of nature's dance, critiqued the plot of the drama of the worlds, made figure and number a key to all that is. The psychoanalysis of cosmic self was traced, its secrets hunted down and read the unknown pathology of the unique. Assessed was the system of the probable, the hazard of fleeing possibilities to account for the actual's unaccountable sum, necessities, logarithmic tables drawn, cast into a scheme, the triple act of the one. Unveiled the abrupt, invisible multitude of forces whirling from the hands of chance, seemed to obey some vast imperative. Their tangled motives worked out unity. A wisdom read their mind to themselves unknown. Their anarchy rammed into a formula, and from their giant randomness of force, following the habit of their million paths, distinguishing each faintest line and stroke of a concealed, unalterable design, out of the chaos of the invisible's moods, derived the calculus of destiny.
In its bright pride of universal lore, mind's knowledge overtopped the omniscience power. The Eternal's winging eagle puissances, surprised in their untracked empyrean, stooped from their gyres to obey the beck of thought. Each mysteried god, forced to revealing form, assigned his settled moves in nature's game, zigzagged at the gesture of a chess player will across the checkerboard of cosmic fate. In the wide sequence of necessity's steps, predicted every act and thought of God, its values weighed by the accountant mind, checked in his mathematized omnipotence, lost its divine aspect of miracle, and was a figure in a cosmic sum. The mighty mother's whims and lightning moods, arisen from her all-wise, unruled delight in the freedom of her sweet and passionate breast, robbed of their wonder, were chained to a cause, an aim. An idol of bronze replaced her mystic shape that captures the movements of the cosmic vasts in the sketch precise of an ideal face forgotten. Was her eyelashes dream print, carrying on their curve infinity's dreams, lost the alluring marvel of her eyes. The surging wave throbs of her vast sea heart, they bound to a theorem of ordered beats. Her deep design, which from herself she had veiled, bowed self-revealed in their confessional. For the birth and death of the worlds, they fixed a date. The diameter of infinity was drawn, measured the distant arc of the unseen heights, and visualized the plumbless, viewless depths till all seemed known that in all time could be.
All was coerced by number, name, and form. Nothing was left untold, incalculable. Yet was their wisdom circled with a knot? Truths they could find and hold, but not the one truth. The highest was to them unknowable. By knowing too much, they missed the whole to be known. The fathomless heart of the world was left unguessed, and the transcendent kept its secrecy.
I'm curious what people think here, because we clearly in the last canto, it was a rational mind, the kingdoms and godheads of the little mind. He walked us through rational mind. Then we descended into vital mind, and then we descended into physical mind. Here it's like the kingdoms and godheads of the greater mind. This is the realm of analytics, calculus, you know, it's all over here. But it seems different. It seems vaster. It seems more like there's more flashes of revelation and intuition. Yeah, what I'm curious what's going on with people reading this.
Well, they are the gods, right? They're right under the infinite, as it were, right? They're between us and that. So they're much vaster than our little mind. They're the gods. And they think of themselves as being all that. That's their downfall. But they are very close to that, actually, because that's where they came from directly. Anyway, that's how I see that.
I read it as a direct parallel with what we were reading yesterday, Matteo, this thing about, because he actually uses that term, overreached. They overreached, which is the same word that he used, that the Vedas used when talking about this context about what's the other god?
Augustia, Indra.
Augustia. Yeah, so Augustia overreaching.
Yeah, and Augustia's us. Yeah.
Yeah.
To me, it seems that this realm of the subtle archangel race is reaching higher and wider. But we have humans that do this. I don't think this is beyond the human realm. And at the same time, they're kind of making a travesty of it, because they have that fatal belief that they are the ones, they are the ones who know. And so there's larger reach, and it's Sherbindo says that really what they're trying to do is make infinity finite. And they take it to the point where this is the truth. And at the end of this area, this passage, he says they miss the one truth, they miss the whole truth by saying, okay, this is the truth. This calculus and these measurements and these audacious lines were traced upon the void. The infinite was reduced to cube and square, to square and cube. It's pragmatically useful what they're doing. And so it's not wasted effort. It's like the realm of science and math. When it thinks that it's the whole of that, then it creates all kinds of error.
Yeah, it seems like the apotheosis of the left brain. And I think it's not exactly like, to speak to your query, Mateo, comparing this section to the lower mind section of the rational, the rational mind, the rational lower mind, I guess. It seems like that might, and I haven't looked back to really verify this, but that there's like the realm of applied and pure science. And, you know, applied science is involved, it's like motivated by some outcome that's desired, right? And so it's using the principles derived from the pure sciences, or at least mathematics, to do that. Here, it seems that the desire is to comprehend the whole. So it is oriented toward pure knowledge. However, it leaves out the heart, it leaves out feeling. So it does achieve a certain amount of, it achieves a certain models, theories of everything, models of the whole. But can I think delude itself into thinking that it's got it now, like now it's achieved, you know, what it was striving for. That obviously turns out to be untrue. It's incomplete. And it's not even half the picture. Like it's just what is allowed to be seen by the mental framework, by the mental way of doing things. So that's just my theory, though. I don't know if that's actually what Aurobindo is saying.
I think that becomes particularly clear when he starts talking about what this mind does with the Mighty Mother's whims and lightning moods. When it turns those, all that passionate infinity into idols of bronze replaced her mystic shape. Forgotten was her eyelashes' dream print. Lost the alluring marvel of her eyes. Now you see some of the losses that this kind of mind, when it thinks that it's the final answer or what it loses.
God, those, what you just read, John Robert, is so beautiful. Oh my goodness. This poetry is just, it's exquisite.
Reminds me of, he uses the image of the surging wave throbs of her vast sea heart, and it reminds me of somebody in a little boat, you know, paddling through the ocean. And the oars and the rudder give you a certain amount of control, but you don't control the ocean. In a little boat. I mean, you don't control the ocean, period. There are stories of the way that the ancient Polynesians navigated between those thousands of miles between the islands and the Pacific. And there have been some recent voyages by native Polynesians who studied the ways that their ancestors used those ways. And it's really a yoga, that kind of navigation, really conscious and not very humble, very awake and humble.
Nainoa Thompson, the Hokulei, the Wade Davis's The Wayfinders. Beautiful description of how the wayfinders are by vision. They're like seers. By vision, they're causing the islands to pop up over the horizon. There's some beautiful descriptors in there.
Shall I continue? Okay. In a sublimer and more daring soar, to the wide summit of the triple stairs, bare steps climbed up like flaming rocks of gold, burning their way to a pure absolute sky. August and few, the sovereign kings of thought, have made of space their wide, all-seeing gaze, surveying the enormous work of time, a breadth of all-containing consciousness, supported being in a still embrace. Intercessors, with a luminous unseen, they capped in the long passage to the world the imperatives of the Creator Self, obeyed by unknowing Earth, by conscious Heaven. Their thoughts are partners in its vast control. A great all-ruling consciousness is there, and mind unwitting serves a higher power. It is a channel, not the source of all. The cosmos is no accident in time. There is a meaning in each play of chance. There is a freedom in each face of fate. A wisdom knows and guides the mysteried world. A truth gaze shapes its beings and events. A word self-born upon creation's heights, voice of the eternal in the temporal spheres, prophet of the seeings of the absolute, sows the idea's significance in form, and from that seed the growths of time arise.
On peaks beyond our ken, the all wisdom sits. A single and infallible look comes down, a silent touch from the supernal's air awakes to ignorant knowledge in its acts, the secret power in the inconscient depths, compelling the blinded Godhead to emerge, determining necessity's new dance as she passes through the circuit of the hours and vanishes from the chase of finite eyes down circling vistas of aeonic time. The unseizable forces of the cosmic world bear in their bacchant limbs the fixity of an original foresight that is fate. Even nature's ignorance is truth's instrument. Our struggling ego cannot change her course. Yet is it a conscious power that moves in us? A seed idea is parent of our acts, and destiny the unrecognized child of will. Infallible by truth's directing gaze, all creatures here their secret self disclose, forced to become what in themselves they hide. For he who is grows manifest in the years, and the slow Godhead shut within the cell climbs from the plasm to immortality. But hidden, but denied to mortal grasp, mystic, ineffable is the spirit's truth, unspoken, caught only by the spirit's eye. When naked of ego and mind, it hears the voice. It looks through light to ever greater light and sees eternity and sphering life. This greater truth is foreign to our thoughts. Where a free wisdom works, they seek for a rule, or we only see a tripping game of chance or a labor in chains forced by bound nature's law, an absolutism of dumb, unthinking power. Audacious in their sense of God-born strength, these dared to grasp with their thought truth's absolute, by an abstract purity of godless sight, by a percept nude, intolerant of forms, they brought to mind what mind could never reach, and hoped to conquer truth's supernal base.
A stripped imperative of conceptual phrase, architectonic and inevitable, translated the unthinkable into thought, a silver-winged fire of naked subtle sense, an ear of mind withdrawn from the outwards rhymes, discovered the seed sounds of the eternal word, the rhythm and music heard that builds the worlds and seized in things the bodiless will to be. The illimitable they measured with numbers rods and traced the last formula of limited things. In transparent systems bodied termless truths, the timeless made accountable to time and valued the incommensurable supreme. To park and hedge the ungrasped infinitudes, they erected absolute walls of thought and speech and made a vacuum to hold the one. In their sight, they drove towards an empty peak, a mighty space of cold and sunlit air. To unify their task, excluding life which cannot bear the nakedness of the vast, they made a cipher of a multitude. In negation found the meaning of the all, and in nothingness the absolute positive. A single law simplest. A single law simplest, the cosmic theme, compressing nature into a formula. Their titan labor made all knowledge one, a mental algebra of the spirit's ways, an abstract of the living divinity. Here the mind's wisdom stopped. It felt complete, for nothing more was left to think or know. In a spiritual zero, it sat throned and took its vast silence for the ineffable.
Some of these lines are really scriptural. Well, probably all of them are, but some of them really stand out in my mind. For he who is grows manifest in the years, and the slow Godhead shut within the cell climbs from the plasm to immortality. So it seems to me that Sri Aurobindo is talking here about the pure mind that Marco mentioned. It reminds me a little bit of now the name. This is a German philosopher. His name escapes me at the moment.
Hegel, maybe?
No, he's pre-Hegel, I think. Hegel is the one whose name came to me, but it's not Hegel, it's Kant.
Mm-hmm.
The realms of mind that are beyond us, that we can't really know, because it's just silence there, or to us it's just silence.
Perhaps what he called the noumenon?
Yeah.
I noticed that the intent is similar to the mathematical kind of mind, but is more spiritual in nature, like more like what are the laws of the universe, or what are the spiritual laws? One line that stuck out for me was, where a free wisdom works, they seek for a rule. Or we only see a tripping game of chance, or a labor in chains forced by bound nature's law, an absolutism of dumb, unthinking power. That reminds me of Nietzsche. I mean, it's like these metaphysics, maybe. Metaphysics is the word that comes to mind. Like these conceptual attempts to frame the totality of reality. And give it a system, or give it which are maybe very useful. Like the evolution of philosophy, like Western philosophy, from Plato through Kant and Hegel, and then to Nietzsche and Heidegger, and into the 20th century. In a way, you could see it as these like attempts to frame reality as such, like frame the whole in more and more adequate terms. But there's also, and this has been like the critique that's arisen in the last century through thinkers like Nietzsche and Heidegger, Martin Heidegger, that there's almost, there's something erroneous in the whole enterprise, like from the beginning, is what, you know, some have pointed out or some have proposed, and that there's an end to philosophy and there's something beyond philosophy that, you know, it's not, can't quite be grasped within philosophical, regular philosophical discourse, the way of trying to form a conception, trying to give a, an order, a kind of a map of the whole. I think that's where this brings me. But I think it also goes not just to those, and I don't think Aurobindo's necessarily just thinking about that particular history, because it seems more generalized as well, and could as well, just as much apply to like certain scientific theories of everything, more scientific theories of everything. There's a line where he says, they erected absolute walls of thought and speech and made a vacuum to hold the one. And I'm thinking of more like physicalist kinds of theories of everything, where, you know, the universe is seen to be kind of manifesting out of a, I'm speaking here just as a layman, and obviously Jeffrey could correct me, but like the quantum vacuum, you know, from which all of material reality kind of condenses. The other thing that was a line Jeffrey read, a word, simplest, a single law, simplest, the cosmic theme. That sounds like a neologism, but I don't know. What do you all think of that one?
Has anyone looked that up in the dictionary?
No, but it did sound like a neologism, but poets have the right to create new words. That's the nature of poetry, so.
I don't begrudge him.
I have a kind of this whole section, architectonic and inevitable, down to the incommensurable supreme. So I made a note earlier when he talked about, hang on, I'll find a reference. The infinite was reduced to square and cube. So, you know, I've been studying Omar Khayyam, and Khayyam had a lot to say about squares and cubes. So I don't know if that's a reference specifically to Khayyam, but it might be. But this whole section on architectonic and inevitable, translating the unthinkable into thought. So Khayyam was a man, he did work on music, number, geometry, time, architecture, and poetry. And all of those themes are addressed in this passage. So for me, it resonates with Khayyam. I don't know whether there was an explicit relationship there, because some of this about some of this reflection about Khayyam's work is more recent scholarship. So I'm not sure that he would have been drawing on it, but it's an interesting, it's a lovely resonance for me, you know, reading about this. So
wasn't the Fitzgerald translation, if I'm getting that right, wasn't that in the late 1800s?
Yes, but it was the poetry end of Khayyam. The sort of, he also wrote papers about number theory and, you know, he worked with architects. The stuff on architecture is more recent scholarship, because it's kind of teasing things out of the historical record that weren't obviously there. So, yeah.
So it is 11:30 plus, thinking of Markov time frame, but we also only have 3 pages left.
Yeah, good to go, Marco?
Yes.
Okay. Shall I?
Yeah, please do.
This was the play of the bright gods of thought, attracting into time the timeless light, imprisoning eternity in the hours. This they have planned, to snare the feet of truth in an aureate net of concept and of phrase, and keep her captive for the thinker's joy in this little world built of immortal dreams. There must she dwell, mured in the human mind, an empress prisoner in her subject's house, adored and pure and still on his heart's throne, his splendid property cherished and apart in the wall of silence of his secret muse, immaculate in white virginity, the same forever and forever one, he worshipped changeless goddess through all time. Or else, a faithful consort of his mind, assenting to his nature and his will, she sanctions and inspires his words and acts, prolonging their resonance through the listening years, companion and recorder of his march, crossing a brilliant tract of thought and life carved out of the eternity of time. A witness to his high triumphant star, her godhead servitor, to a crowned idea, he shall dominate by her a prostrate world, a warrant for his deeds and his beliefs. She attests his right divine to lead and rule. Or as a lover clasps his one beloved, godhead of his life's worship and desire, icon of his heart's sole idolatry, she now is his and must live for him alone. She has invaded him with her sudden bliss, an exhaustless marvel in his happy grasp, an allurement, a caught ravishing miracle. Her now he claims, after long rapt pursuit, the one joy of his body and his soul. Inescapable is her divine appeal, her immense possession, an undying thrill, an intoxication and an ecstasy. The passion of her self-revealing moods, a heavenly glory and variety, makes ever new her body to his eyes, or else repeats the first enchantment's touch, the luminous rapture of her mystic breasts and beautiful, vibrant limbs, a living field of throbbing new discovery without end.
A new beginning flowers in word and laugh. A new charm brings back the old extreme delight. He is lost in her. She is his heaven here. Truth smiled upon the gracious golden game. Out of her hushed eternal spaces leaned the great and boundless goddess, feigned to yield the sunlight, the sunlit sweetness of her secrecies. Incarnating her beauty in his clasp, she gave for a brief kiss her immortal lips and drew to her bosom one glorified mortal head. She made earth her home, for whom heaven was too small. In a human breast, her occult presence lived. He carved from his own self his figure of her. She shaped her body to a mind's embrace. Into thought's narrow limits she has come. Her greatness she has suffered to be pressed into the little cabin of the idea, the closed room of a lonely thinker's grasp. She has lowered her heights to the stature of our souls and dazzled our lids with her celestial gaze. Thus each is satisfied with his high gain and thinks himself beyond mortality blessed, a king of truth upon his separate throne. To her possessor in the field of time, a single splendor caught from her glory seems the one true light, her beauty's glowing whole.
But thought nor word can seize eternal truth. The whole world lives in a lonely ray of her sun. In our thinking's close and narrow lamplit house, the vanity of our shut mortal mind dreams that the chains of thought have made her ours. But only we play with our own brilliant bonds. Tying her down, it is ourselves we tie. In our hypnosis, by one luminous point, we see not what small figure of her we hold. We feel not her inspiring boundlessness. We share not her immortal liberty. Thus is it even with the seer and sage, for still the human limits the divine. Out of our thoughts we must leap up to sight, breathe her divine, illimitable air, her simple, vast supremacy confess, dare to surrender to her absolute. Then the unmanifest reflects his form in the still mind as in a living glass. The timeless ray descends into our hearts, and we are wrapped into eternity. For truth is wider, greater than her forms. A thousand icons they have made of her, and find her in the idols they adore. But she remains herself and infinite. End of Canto 11.
So is this passage, I understood the she, I went back to look at it and it looked like it's light. Is that correct?
It's truth.
Oh, truth, light, but kind of put together, yeah. A lovely reference to Blake in that imprisoning eternity in the hours. Yeah.
Also, in a human breast, her occult presence lived. Blake said all gods and goddesses live in the human breast.
Another magnificent canto, and surely we've reached the height of savitri by now.
I can feel the Divine Mother close. We've actually come a long way as far as the story goes. they're drawing near to each other, very near.
I should get going soon, but I just want to say I think this is a great reminder of the limits of mind, and even of an extraordinary mind, like the seer or sage, he mentions, for still the human limits the divine. And then the aspect of surrender here is one that I think I want to meditate on. That one's tough for me.
Dare to surrender to her absolute.
Dare. Concept, dare to know. That was his rallying cry. This is maybe the other side of that.
So on that note, shall we have a few minutes of surrender?
Thank you, everybody. Lovely reading today.
Yeah, thank you. Bye bye.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
You all too.
Adios.